This is Meet the Writers, and I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has written some of the most riveting biographies of recent years, a passionate culture historian. Her book, Desperate Romantics, which delves into the bohemian private lives of the Pre-Raphaelites, was adapted into a hit television drama, and her most recent work, The Extraordinary Life and Times of J.M.W. Turner, was released in 2016. She started her career at the BBC, becoming the corporation's first ever dedicated commissioner for arts and culture, before deciding to go freelance. In addition to her writing, she continues to work as a TV producer, lecturer, and a trustee of the Hackney Empire. Franny Moyle, thank you so much for coming on Meet the Writers.
My pleasure.
Now, you are in the midst of a fascinating multi-strand career, and I wanted to go right back and look at the genesis of it all, because tell me about growing up and your eventual decision to study English and the history of art at Cambridge.
I come from a family of artists. I've got a big arts background. My mother was a head of a school of art, and my godfather was a founder member of the Dada movement, and I was brought up part of the time in the south of France with him. And so as a young child, art was all around me, and it was obvious to me that I would have to do something that involved the visual arts. And I thought for a while I might be a sort of fabulously famous painter or something like this. And I remember having a conversation with my mother about this, because I was a reasonable draftswoman. You know, I'm reasonably skillful at drawing. And I remember having a sort of conversation with my mother about, yeah, maybe I'll be a fine artist. And she just looked at me and she said, do you know what, Franny? If there's a maybe, I really don't think you're going to be. It was a very sort of salutary moment when I realised that this is serious, art is serious, it has to be a calling. And I didn't have it. But what I did have was this huge passion for the visual arts, this constant magnetic draw to painting primarily, but of course sculpture and everything else, but really the painting. And I suppose when it came to university choices, history of art seemed the obvious. In those days, I don't know whether what the case is now, you couldn't go straight in and read history of art first off at Cambridge. You had to do a part one in English. Seemed obvious. I enjoyed writing. And so that's how it all began. So I did my part one in English and then transferred over and did my part two in history of art. The two sides, I suppose, of the Franny Moyle career was sort of forged at that moment.
I mean, most people would then have gone in perhaps to work in a museum or some kind of big institution.
Yes, I've got no idea why I didn't do that. I was really stupid. I mean, everyone else in my class of whatever it was, 80 whatever, you know, loads of them went to work for Sotheby's and Christie's and or a path into museum and curatorial work. But I always loved telly as well, in this sort of strange combination of influences. You know, I was a telly junkie and I just thought it'd be great to work in television. And I thought it would be great to make arts programmes. And that became my ambition. And, you know, I was lucky enough to eventually crack my way into that.
Because you joined the BBC, I think it was in 1992, and you started off doing things like Homefront, which of course is very far away from, well, perhaps not that far away though, it's an interiors programme.
Funnily enough, in those days, Homefront was actually run out of the arts department. And so, like all these things when you're young, you know, it's a jewel. The first job is a jewel. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's somewhere in the right direction, of course, it was a gorgeous programme.
A makeover show.
Yeah, yeah, correct. A makeover show, sort of interiors makeover, one of the very first. But it was part of the arts department and was my sort of foothold in that department. And gradually, I was able to move over and work on programmes that were more purely what would consider an arts programme, and ended up running the department. I was very fortunate in doing that.
Well, that was a whole new role. It was the corporation's first commissioner for arts and culture. So what did you have to do?
Oh, gosh. I commissioned everything. I mean, it was at the time that BBC Four launched, around that time. And so I was responsible, again, it's rather ancient history, but I was responsible for commissioning all the arts and cultural programmes across the four channels. And I worked alongside Peter Manura, who was then head of music, and we commissioned music together as well. So it was a vast job. It was a sort of huge slate. And in many ways, I deeply regret having let go of it. But also, I suppose, going right the way back to that deep past we talked about my family, who are variously sort of artists, it was ultimately a managerial job with huge creative capacity, of course, as all these jobs do, a lot of editorial, strategic oversight and so on and so forth. But there was a bit of me that was always remembering that conversation I had with my mum about wanting to be an artist, do something myself, do something personally rather than the person commissioning or whatever. And I suppose that niggle never went away, that rather sort of selfish impulse that I wanted to be at the centre of my own work rather than on the periphery as a sort of producer. And so in answer to your very original question, that's how the current career that I have, which is sort of multi-strand, has happened, because I sort of jumped out to write a book. Madness, perhaps. Certainly, I still continue to ask myself whether it was the right decision, but we've started now, so we've got to complete this journey.
Because, of course, what it's done, it's married the two beautifully, because your first book, Desperate Romantics, The Private Lives of the Pre-Raphaelites, was adapted into a BBC drama. So which came first, the book or the television series?
I actually pitched them simultaneously, astonishingly, and I've never been able to do that again. I mean, I've never pulled that off since, although I'd love to. Note to self, try harder. But I knew I was leaving the BBC. I'd taken that decision. And I had planned out a book in huge detail. I mean, I have to say that it was, you know, I don't know, there's probably 30 or 40,000 words of chapter breakdowns already done. So, you know, it was a property, if you like, that could be sold in. And at the point I was talking to publishers, I was talking to television commissioners, and everyone said yes at the same time. And then it was a real sort of panic to write fast. But as it turned out, drama takes so long anyway, the two things sort of caught up with one another. I think in the end, the book was published first, and then the series followed quite shortly after. You know, it was just one of those things.
You didn't write the series yourself?
No, Peter Bowker wrote the series, and I was an executive producer, so with some insight and input into the casting and the scripts. But we gave Pete quite a lot of leeway, because what I did feel with my sort of producer head on was that I needed to sort of let go of my book and give him the opportunity to be playful and turn it into the drama he wanted. So that's what we did.
And it was hugely successful, as was your second book, Constance, The Tragic and Scandalous Life of Mrs. Oscar Wilde. That came out in 2011, again to huge critical acclaim. And it's the extraordinary account of their marriage played out under public scrutiny, which reminded me so much of celebrity culture today. Really, very little's changed.
Well, I think that's right, and particularly because Oscar Wilde, of course, courted celebrity. He wanted to be seen. He had a very public persona. And in a way, you know, that public mask that he had adopted was so integral to his life, it was inevitable that Constance was going to be drawn into that.
Mm. She's often very overlooked, though. I mean, we concentrate on Oscar. We don't care about Constance, although the reader of your book absolutely does. It's an absolute tearjerker, really, towards the end.
Well, it's a terribly tragic story. I mean, it is the most tragic story. I find what's interesting is when I was in the process of writing that book, people asked me what I was up to, friends, colleagues, you know, dinner party, people I've never met before. And I sort of said, well, you know, I'm writing a book. It's about Mrs. Oscar Wilde. Quite a few people laughed and thought it was fiction. They thought it was an imagined fictional idea of what a Mrs. Oscar Wilde might be, because honestly, quite a lot of people didn't realise that Oscar had a wife, was married. They thought that I was writing some sort of playful imagining. And I thought that was really fascinating because this image of the great gay martyr, important image, of course, has eclipsed so much the version of Oscar that his contemporaries would have understood, who would have known him as the married man, who would have known Constance because she was very much in the public eye. And what I do think happened is fascinating because I think in the scandal, after the scandal when Oscar went on trial and went to prison for homosexual crimes, a great many of their friends dropped them, of course. You know, they didn't want to be sort of tarred with the scandal. And a great many dropped Constance. And you look back through the sort of memoirs that a lot of sort of lesser people wrote who I knew were Oscar and Constance's friends. And not only had he been written out of, you know, their memoirs, but so had Constance. So I think that was the first stage at which she vanished. Mm. You know, people suddenly didn't want to be associated. But I think the second reason why Constance vanished is an interesting one, because, of course, Oscar's legacy was so tainted in the first part of the 20th century that it was really only a very dedicated band of academics, supporters, friends who kept his flame alive. And they did tend to be members of the gay community. His work and his status as a convicted homosexual became slightly wrapped up with one another. And I do think that, therefore, those writing and talking and promoting Oscar, it wasn't really in their interests to talk about him as a married man, to resurrect that particularly. It didn't really serve their agenda at that time. Mm. So again, that was another sort of crack for her to fall through. And I think only now, when all that's played out and, you know, he is so embraced again, of course, as a writer and as a personality, that one has the opportunity, in fact, to paint that portrait of him again now, and rather surprisingly, as someone who was married and remained married. I mean, they never divorced.
Mm. I mean, as you point out, it's not fiction. And so when you're writing something that's so fact-based, there's also the danger that you're brushing up against your contemporaries now who are somehow related to the story. So, for instance, I think you met his grandson.
Oh, absolutely. Merlin Holland, who's still very much around, actually. Merlin is astonishing because you think, surely there can't be a grandchild of Oscar Wilde still alive. But Oscar's son, Vivian, Merlin's father, had Merlin very late in his life. I can't quite do the maths, but he was perhaps in his late 50s or early 60s. And so there is still a descendant very much alive and kicking. And his insight, of course, is fascinating because, you know, this is close family history. Mm. These are his grandparents. And he was not only enormously generous with family photographs, family letters, and his own vast personal knowledge and scholarship. But he was also, I think, genuinely very concerned that the story of his grandmother was brought back into the public domain. Because, you know, his view of that relationship was that there was a foundation of a proper love affair originally. And the fact that Constance stuck with Oscar throughout, in as much as she could, throughout his troubles, I think, is something that the family have been very aware of.
Mm. Are there any family members of Turner? Because, of course, he was the subject of your next biography.
Well, there are, actually, and I did meet them. Turner's official estate, because his daughters were illegitimate, his official estate when he died passed to cousins. And there is absolutely a Mrs. Turner, a descendant of that line of cousins, who is a very important figure in Turner sort of scholarship and Turner circles, because she still owns a huge amount of Turner's personal library, important you know, works of art, items of furniture. So I went and met her, and she was very generous in sort of allowing me to look through some of his books and so on and so forth. But there are also descendants of his illegitimate daughter who I tracked down and met, and who don't have very much, but have some lovely things like Turner's daughter's wedding ring and, you know, stuff like that. And so, yes, there are family members around, a little bit more remote than the Wilds, obviously.
I wonder what the process is of looking at a huge life like Turner's, and somebody who, certainly for British people, we all feel that we know, we're familiar with his work, to shed a new light on this, and the process of getting all of that together.
It takes a very long time, that's all I can say. I mean, this is the sort of nutty part of my self-determined job as biographer, because you leap in where others are very expert. I feel quite confident in claiming to be an expert on Turner. At the point I started the book, of course, I wasn't. And same with Wilde, same with the Pre-Raphaelites. And so it's a dangerous path to take. One leaps in, and what you have to do is you have to get up to speed. I mean, it took me about 3 years to read every bit of scholarship I could get my hands on about Turner, just so I kind of knew where the debate was, there weren't any sort of, you know, hidden things that would trip me up and so on and so forth. And that even before I then start delving into my own primary research. You sort of have to do that. You have to put in the hours.
Mm. And it's more than just having a list of credible facts, though. I mean, this is an incredibly readable book. You've got to have the literary talent to put it all together.
Well, thank you. Yes, I mean, I think biography is more than just a sort of factual account. It is more than just a collection of facts. It has to be, in my view, an enjoyable reading experience. And I think art history is particularly interesting. And I hope the world of art history will forgive me when I say this, but I think as a genre, it lacks writers writing for the widest possible audience, generally. Obviously, there are some, but it is an area of scholarship where there are a great many brilliant, brilliant art historians, but whose agendas are very much to do with scholarship or curatorial. And I'm not sure how many art historians are writers in the sense of trying to capture a mainstream audience and engage a mainstream audience with these great figures and these great themes that come out of history of art. Now, there are some, but to me, it seemed like a territory, if you like, that is still rather underexploited, not in terms of scholarship, but in terms of a sort of more mainstream readership.
And I think maybe that goes back to things like your work on Homefront, where you're making television for the common denominator, for the masses, people who want something cultural, but they're not necessarily highbrow. And here you have this incredibly accessible biography about this great cultural figure.
I think that's right. And I think it's a real problem with the whole history of the history of art. I mean, painting art was, you know, elite until the 19th century and arguably continues to be elite. You know, the world of art was a world that was occupied and enjoyed by the upper classes, those who could commission works. And, you know, let's not forget there wasn't even a National Gallery until sort of the early 19th century. And so before reproduction, you know, this was the world of the aristocrat or the extremely rich business person who could look at paintings in private galleries, afford reproduction. And I think that has weirdly filters down even today, because yes, we have public galleries. Yes, we have masses of reproductions of great works. Art history tends not to be taught in school, certainly tends not to be taught in state school. It's certainly not on the curricula. And so even though we have these great public galleries, those who are going there, I think, are still sort of self-selecting. And it's complicated, is what I'm trying to say. And I think all this feeds in to this underrepresentation of our writing about art for a mainstream audience. And that's why I wanted to work in telly, because telly is such a great way of reaching a wider audience. But of course, telly can only do so much. You know, an hour on Van Gogh can only do so much, and an hour on Turner can only do so much. It can really ignite people's interest, and it can show work, of course, beautifully in a way books can't. But what it can't get people into with the best will in the world is that sort of detail, and you know, it really, really can't. And so I suppose that was what was behind my real desire to start writing, you know, long form.
Mm. And you're involved in contemporary culture in other ways. For instance, your Hackney Empire.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I live in Hackney, and so I'm a trustee of the Hackney Empire, and I'm enormously passionate about that theatre and the work it does. Yeah. Mm.
And what is that adding, do you think, to the contemporary cultural debate? What's going on in Hackney?
Well, I think what's really interesting amid our sort of debate about diversity, which is so live at the moment, is that here you have a theatre in the heart of one of London's most diverse boroughs. I mean, Hackney really is. And it's a theatre that, particularly in its engagement programmes with young people, but also, of course, in its agenda in terms of what programmes it brings to the community and what programmes it produces for the community, it's really trying to produce diverse theatre from the ground up, if you know what I mean. This is, obviously, this is not any kind of token diversity. And it's, you know, in fairness to the Empire, it's been doing that for a very long time. But right now, I think it has a real place. And they run a programme every summer called the Artist Development Programme, where they audition, open auditions for anyone aged 13 to 19, and then they give them 2 weeks of training. And these young people write and produce a piece of musical theatre together, which they stage for one night on the main show. And this time, this year, it was called Legacy. It was about immigration. It was about, you know, the story of diverse communities in the UK. And these young people occupied that story in such a different way. And it was a great joy to watch. So I'm enormously proud of the, you know, the very small amount I can sort of give to the theatre as a trustee in terms of sport, but I'm very proud of it.
Mm. And meanwhile, of course, your attention hasn't wavered from major artistic figures from history. You've got another one on the go.
Yes, again, leaping in just as I've become extremely confident about 18th and 19th century history, I've gone mad and leapt it back into Tudor history with a book in process on Holbein.
Which is coming out?
That's a difficult question to ask an author, yeah. Particularly, a couple of years.
Yeah, because, of course, you do go through such an intense research period.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I'm just in that period at the moment where I am reading. Yeah. And, you know, following all the footnotes, one reads a lot of very, very detailed and specific scholarship to immerse oneself in that world.
Yeah. And we're going to be discussing this more because unfortunately we've run out of time now. But in fact, we're going to be on the stage together at the Royal Academy Festival of Ideas. Our session's on Monday, the 10th of September, but the festival runs, I think, from the 7th to the 16th of September with a huge amount of different sessions on. In fact, there's a lot about that on Sunday Brunch. You can download that from our archives if you want more detail, or just go to the Royal Academy site, because Franny and I will be talking really about the process of writing biographies and how you go about it and why they're important to our cultural debate.
Yes, well, I'm looking forward to that and hope it'll be a sort of rich discussion.
I'm quite sure it will. Franny Moyle's book on Turner is published by Viking. It's out now. Franny, thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Anna Savetska, Christy Evans and Megan Atkinson. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.